Hello, and welcome to Not Quite Great Books, a TV podcast. I'm one of your hosts, John McMahon, and joining me on the other line, just back from youth group, and oh my, where there's so many cute boys cooing about Jesus, it's Danielle Hanley.
Oh, I hate
that's,
it.
That's your favorite intro that's ever been provided for you,
literally,
correct?
Not at all, but honestly, that was an amazing intro.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it. There's a lot of Jesus and other religious figures floating around this episode of The Americans.
This was really tough for me. I have a weird relationship to religion, which we are going to get into in this episode.
Absolutely.
But there was so much Jesus. Thank goodness there were not that many, like, visual representations of Jesus, because that's really where I lose my mind and I, like, can't handle it. And this is from someone who lived in Jerusalem, where there are representations of Jesus all over the place.
Yeah, tough episode for Danielle when it comes to all the Christian shit that happens.
So tough. But alas, here we are.
We're talking about American Season 2, Episode 4, A Little Night Music. We'll talk about that episode name, I think, in one of the segments. It's not, surprisingly, a reference to, like, the Immaculate Conception or something. It's directed by Lodge Kerrigan and written by Stephen Schiff. And Danielle, what is our IMDb summary this week?
Yeah, so the IMDb summary says that just when Philip and Elizabeth think they have a quiet road ahead, an old friend returns to complicate things. Okay. Not only do they have to intercept a target who could prove valuable to the Soviet Union, but they also have to take on an important rogue mission without the support of the center. Divisions inside the Residentura deepen between Oleg and Arkady, and there's an upheaval at the FBI as the chickens come home to roost for Agent Gad. Meanwhile, Martha's frustrations threaten to blow Philip's cover.
So many things happening there. But let's start where we began this episode with the cooing about Jesus, and that is with the theme of religion. And so do you want to start by talking about Anton Baklanov, who is the defector, who is seemingly helping the Americans with their stealth aircraft technology, and we get the opening scene with him in Shul? Or do you want to start with Paige?
First of all, nice use of the term shul. Very impressed. Those Brooklyn years are really doing you some good.
Even before Brooklyn, actually.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Look at you. Amazing. I mean, I didn't know that term until I moved to New York.
We can talk more off air about the origins of my occasional knowledge of Judaism.
Great. let's start in shul just because it's an interesting, like, entry into this episode when the rest of the episode is going to be dripping with Jesus, that we're like in a synagogue. And not only are we in a synagogue, but we've got like Russian refusenik, we've got like the rabbi sort of speaking Hebrew, questionable there. I was like, oh, the pronunciation, I'm already annoyed, please get us out of this shul.
How did you feel about the one and only Philip Jennings in cosplay / Jew face mode?
I didn't love it. I was like, why is Philip in a shul? That was my first question. And then I was like, why does Philip like wearing a Jewish costume? Not a yarmulke, like not like a like an obvious Jewish costume, but like there was something about his wig and his suit that just felt like
in the facial hair, right?
Yeah. Just like there was something about it that like gave Shabbat morning vibes that I was not into for Philip.
Right. And so, I mean, why do you think that do you think there's any significance to the show introducing this character of Anton Baklanov through the lens of him being a refusnik and through the lens of this introduction happening literally in the synagogue?
Yeah, I mean, the thing that I kept coming back to was like the sort of intertwining of religion and the state is something that like we're given already in that beginning scene. And that's something that Philip and Elizabeth are going to have, albeit different, but like, they're going to have a lot of responses to, and a lot of their issues with Paige sort of come back to this question of like, what's the role of religion with regard to state authority? And so I think sort of starting in the synagogue gives us the opposite picture of like where Philip and Elizabeth are going to take us.
Yeah, I think that's a smart point, because there's a strange way in which this episode has a kind of narrative or structural pairing of Bakhlanov and Paige vis-a-vis Philip and Elizabeth, right? I think the show is operating as if Philip and Elizabeth are concerned that just as religion contributed to the defection of Anton Bakhlanov to America, so too might, admittedly, a very different religion contribute to the feared defection of their daughter to the U.S. as well.
Absolutely. And they say as much. And I think like there is something really, when I was watching it, I was like, ooh, Elizabeth's reactions are just like so stereotypical. Like what I associate the like communist party reaction to religion, like the Marx, like this is the opiate of the masses, the really like, simplistic reading of that idea in Marx,
right.
Which I have had many a fight with many of people about.
Which, like, Elizabeth should know better. Like, clearly she should have gotten better Marx education. Like, they should have read some, like, German ideology or thesis on Feuerbach or...
100%. 100%. Or even, like, the next line that he said, right? Like,
also that.
Like, it's, like, it's so much more than that, but that's, like, that's the piece that gets parroted out. So there was something really stereotypical about that reaction. And so I think your point about the parallels between Bakhlanov and Paige being similarly like permeated and like damaged by religion, that it was going to pull them in the wrong direction to make them deviants. Like that tracks with the like kind of communist ideology that we see from Elizabeth over and over again. So it makes sense that like she and Philip to some extent are viewing both of these characters, one their daughter and one like a potential operative, as like being impacted in the same way, because religion is the same thing regardless of like what the beliefs are.
And I mean, Elizabeth is so intense, not only about the religion is the opiate of the masses situation, mm-hmm. but the speech she gives to Philip when they're in the car at the end of the episode, waiting to ambush Bakhlanov, I would add. So there's a way in which then at the end of the episode, Bakhlanov comes back. And so too does the question of religion, albeit this time it's explicitly in relation to Paige.
Yeah.
So some of her lines include, they get them when they're children. They indoctrinate them with friendship and songs and cute boys cooing about Jesus. So it's the insidiousness that Elizabeth attributes to the vaguely Protestant, like hip Protestant church that Paige is being pulled into by Kelly, that is so strong.
So I have a question for you, which takes us a little bit off this track, but I'm interested in it. Do you have any friends, any of your, like, I would say, like, super lefty friends who were brought up religious and have, like, have shifted their devotion to, like, the lefty cause and like, that in the broadest possible way? Do you have any friends that have made that transition?
I wouldn't say who have made that transition, but like I know a lot of people for whom that was the impetus to orient themselves towards social justice initially. And then some point down the line, they went down the rabbit hole with or without losing their religion, so to speak.
That's like such a nicer and more interesting trajectory. There are a number of people that I know who were brought up painfully religious, right? Like religious in a punishing way, usually Catholic, although not exclusively, and who now like self-identify as Marxist or left of that, and the devotion with which they can like quote chapter and verse like ideas from Marx is the same kind of devotion that like I envision they were made to engage with like the New Testament. And so there's like, there is, it jumped to my brain because the way that when you were reading the quotes back from Elizabeth, it's like, yeah, that's also what the Communist Party does in Russia. Like the inability to see the sort of way in which her own life is structured through that same kind of like top-down imposition, although it's not it's not religious, it's political, but it's political devotion that borders on religious.
Right. I mean, you're interpreting sacred but materialist texts. You're engaging in some eschatology. You're doing all of these things.
And there's transubstantiation, though it's in a different way. That's one of Anne's favorite things to talk about is like Marx and transubstantiation.
I believe that. There's a certain kind of flip side to that that we observe, particularly in American politics, where you have a lot of people defecting from the left to neoconservatism or from the left to a certain kind of evangelical Christianity. You know, and I'm the one person that kind of I'm thinking of back to your original question, who they, I don't think you know this person, they were raised as a Christian Scientist and now are like an unabashed leftist, or they had one parent who was a Christian Scientist. So, but I had some elements of that in their life. So that's the kind of specific concrete version of it that I can think of in my own life. I mean, I was a Christmas and Easter Catholic growing up. Like, I never did Catholic version of youth group. I mean, I'm baptized and confirmed or whatever. I haven't imbibed the body and blood of Jesus in a very long time.
I want you to never say those words again. This podcast is just like...
You brought up transubstantiation.
I know, but I
wasn't... Like that's a return of the repressed situation, I would suggest.
It's a different kind of repressed.
There's another aspect of Philip and Elizabeth, and particularly Elizabeth's response to Paige and indirectly to Bulkhanov, that amplifies even the like indoctrination part or their teach you when you're young part, where it is as if religion is portrayed as the most real danger to the sanctity of their Soviet but fakes or implicit hidden Soviet household. So not only does she say that they get them when they're young or whatever, but also that we promise to protect the kids from the big dangers in life, danger of life and death, and then quote, and something finds its way into your own house. End quote. It's not the fact that Elizabeth has literally been abducted within her own house before. It's not the fact that Stan almost caught them and literally the first episode. It's not the very explicit dangers to their kids' lives that has been one of the major themes for Elizabeth and Philip vis-a-vis Paige and Henry in the first parts of the episode. It is Paige's budding religiosity that is this great threat to them, because they let, you know, Elizabeth says, we let our guard down, we're failing them, look at this country, church, synagogue, consumerism, the opiate of the masses.
Oh, just playing all the hits. No, I mean, I think that was also something that was striking to me, that like, this is the big danger, and yet like Elizabeth, not four episodes ago, was shot and maybe wasn't going to survive, right? And like, they literally just watched their friends and their friend's child like get murdered, but the danger is immaterial religion. It's fascinating because it goes, I think, like what it helps do is just cement how Soviet Elizabeth is in her perspective and in her approach, that like, of course, for someone who is indoctrinated with this particular ideology, religion is the scary thing and not the actual like physical, like potential like physical impediments and harms that literally lurk in their neighbor's yard.
And I think this is tied to Elizabeth, something Claudia says about Elizabeth, because Claudia back in this episode, right? That Elizabeth,
we'll get into it,
is still afraid, is too afraid to be back and operational. And here Elizabeth's, I was so worried about the physical danger to the kids, and I tell Philip that I've never been so afraid for them. They've never been in as much physical danger of their lives. And now the danger is the religion that's seeping in insidiously into the home. So just her kind of jumping around and inability to maintain some sort of perspective is, I think, indicative of the state that she is in with regards to her children, but also with regards to her life and work as a spy with regards to the Soviet Union itself.
I think that like perhaps we're meant to read that as like how impacted she is by everything being turned upside down for her, by sort of realizing that the world like, that her life is dangerous, that she puts her kids in danger literally every day, that there's this sort of, like, earth-shattering thing that has happened for Elizabeth, and like, the fallout of that is this, like, frustrating inconsistency that we are now, like, meant to watch.
Right. Philip is responding to this kind of. In fact, he responds with a joke of, we had dinner early tonight. Tomorrow, let's eat a lot later because it's harder. You don't want to say grace as much if you're hungry.
Honestly, when Philip said that, I was like, great analysis. Like,
he's not wrong.
But Elizabeth loses her mind.
So reasonable, she says. Yeah.
She's like so angry at his pragmatism, but like, again, like that's the distinction between the two of them that we've seen sort of not fully consistently, but generally pretty consistently the entire time. Philip is more reserved and pragmatic about his responses for the most part. And Elizabeth, her politics, her responses, like all of it is just like a bit more extreme. I mean, we see Philip anticipate this when he brings Henry with him, like, in episode one, where, like, they're at the carnival and he uses Henry. He thinks Elizabeth's going to be angry at him because her responses to everything are so extreme. So this is just a really funny version of, like, the extremity of Elizabeth against the, like, pragmatism of Philip.
It is. And then how, Danielle, do you see Paige's own agency, like desire in a psychoanalytic or conscious intentional sense, have functioning such that this church youth group, for the moment at least, appears to be this place of, let's call it, sanctuary to maintain the thematics?
No one can see my face, but I'm literally gagging over here by the use of the term sanctuary and things like that. No, I mean, I think the question is an apt one. Like, there is an ambiguity here, though, or rather, like, I would say there's something ambiguous, or maybe something, there's a little bit of tension for me, because on the one hand, of course, the, like, relationship with Kelly going to this church group, like, Paige isn't like, hey, I'm so excited about church in the beginning, like, please take me to church with you. It's just where they end up. And then I think she's excited about being in a space with people who are like, it's a new set of people. Kelly is this new cool friend. She's got a cool perm, like the whole deal of it. The place where I felt the tension really come up is like, okay, so she's like reading the Bible. She wants to like fit into this group, fine. But then when she says grace, I was like, that feels like a little too quick, but it also does feel very teenage girl. Like, I want to fit in.
It's so perceptive on her part to realize how offensive her becoming even somewhat religious would be as an act of teenage rebellion against her parents. So there's that, perhaps maybe conscious to her desire to find some sort of community, because we actually don't see her with friends or talking about friends that often for, you know, a 14 or 15 year old girl. At this point. So she has that community aspect. But there's also like this unconscious desire to rebel against one's parents that is probably a mix of something that is intentional or that she recognizes and something that is operating on a less consciously available level to her. So that maybe that helps explain why she jumps immediately from never talking about religion at all to going to youth group, to reading the Bible in her room, to silently, except for the amen, saying grace at the
I had to rewind it. I was like, did I miss something here? I think that that's right. I think like reading it as an act of teenage rebellion is productive. But I also think there's like a non-rebellious part of this that's just Paige wants connection. It's a thing that I think we can read into her like snooping also.
Yes.
Is she wants to like understand. She wants connection. So
yes.
I think the saying grace or like saying grace or saying amen after saying grace before eating was like weird for me because it was loosely connected, right? Like it's a couple of steps away from connection, but I can absolutely see in the mind of a teenage girl, myself having been one, the like, okay, well, if I do this, other people are also doing this. And so I'm doing the thing that everybody else is doing. And so I feel like I'm part of something.
Right. And I also am concerned, or not concerned, but I'm wondering the extent to which another sort of perhaps unconscious drive that is motivating Paige here is she doesn't know it. She doesn't understand that her parents are at least, or at least one of her parents is a firm believer in something as ideologically and politically and philosophically and socially robust and comprehensive as yeah. Marxism or Marxism Leninism or the Soviet Union or however we want to frame it. Mm-hmm. So maybe she is also searching out for some world system, some overarching framework in which she could believe as well.
Yeah, I think that that's right. And I think, like, as a teenager, you don't necessarily know that you're grasping for, a world or, like, an orientation like that.
Yeah.
But, like, and that's often, I mean, Elizabeth is not wrong. That's why it is easy to get them when they're young, right? Like, plenty of my friends went to different kinds of youth groups, and those ideas, like, and the indoctrination that they experienced, regardless of religion, regardless of political perspective, those ideas have stuck with those friends even after they have left those groups, right? So, like, she's not wrong.
Yeah, I mean, I had plenty of friends, like, in youth groups of various yeah. sorts in middle school and high school. And, like, that was a major part of their lives. And that's...
Yeah.
You know, of varying Protestant denominations, let's say, like from the evangelical to the more mainline or chiller Protestants.
My sisters and I have been watching this documentary on Netflix about polygamous Mormons, like the Fundamental Church of Latter-day Saints, FLDS. Yeah. And that's what's sticking in my brain now. A different deep dive for a different podcast.
Yeah, when we do Under the Banner of Heaven.
Oh my God. Scariest book I've ever read.
Part of what's happening with Paige as well is the theme that was brought up so directly by Philip last episode yes. of lying also becomes very explicit in this episode as well. So Paige hiding the Bible under the pillow in her room is subjectively hilarious to me.
The Bible is also so big.
The Bible is a large book. She's just like, I'm reading it for school. And then, so she has a couple different times in this episode, she's like got her lines about where she was, what she's doing. She has planned either again, consciously or unconsciously, exactly what's happening and how she's going to respond when she gets questioned by the parents. And yeah. they usually, but not entirely, see right through it, including not recognizing what's going on until it's too late from their perspective. So, but there's the page hiding the Bible. She gives this line of, well, I met this friend, Kelly. She has a messed up family. And that's the other kind of aspect to what's bringing her to the youth group, to the church, to the community, is this by implication that she has a messed up family, which is true.
Which is true, but like she doesn't fully know it. Right. Correct. Like correct. She just like as a teenager has a messed up family. Right. Like where I'm sure I like screamed at my parents at some point, like our family's so messed up. Right. It's like the natural reaction. So. Right. But Elizabeth is so offended by it.
And Philip is so offended, or at least gives the line to Paige that he's so offended by the lying, particularly after the conversation they had yeah. in the previous episode, right? He says, you know, it's about the lying. It's not about youth group or the family or whatever. It's about the lying. Paige, of course, throws back the line that she got earlier in the season about don't we all have privacy around here?
In my notes say, whoa, crazy weaponization of privacy here. Locke would be proud.
Yeah.
But like, honestly, impressive work done by Paige there. Like, I love a teenager throwing the parents' lines back at the parents and being like, I listened when you talked.
Absolutely. It's good. It's a good work by Paige there.
I'm here for it. Should we shift to thinking a little bit about Stan and Philip?
Yes. There's some more lying that abounds in their conversation.
Exactly. Oh, an amazing transition.
By you. You set it up by just like, you know, making it explicit for the audience.
This is good teamwork. It's good teamwork here.
Yeah.
So I have in my notes, I know the
it's
audience.
It's good fellowship, Danielle. I'm not going to pass up any further opportunities throughout the episode to perhaps make this slightly uncomfortable in the religious realm.
Deeply uncomfortable, but I'm going to keep shifting it back to my political theory work. It's choral, if you will.
Okay. Look, Danielle and I just found out right before recording that the band Hole was named after a Euripides line that Courtney Love vaguely remembered. So, like,
from Medea, which is a play I literally have spent 3 years writing about.
So before we started actually playing this episode, Danielle and I had an extensive conversation about that. So we're in that realm.
We're in it.
Courtney Love for the win always.
Most of the time, yeah. I mean, I feel like Hole is timeless.
Yes, absolutely.
I did just get a text from my dad saying that Harry Styles' Matilda was on the radio to me and all my sisters. So my dad is listening to Harry Styles.
I'm impressed. I'd consider that a major accomplishment in your life.
Wait, I have another. Okay, Harry Styles digression.
Corner, yeah.
So we're sitting at the, I was home this weekend, which John knows. We're sitting at the dinner table on Saturday and it's like the whole family. So it's like me, my three sisters, my brother, my mom, my dad, my aunt, my cousin and her husband, the whole family and also two dogs. And I don't know, somehow we were talking about, obviously we were talking about Harry Styles. My sisters are Harry Styles fans too.
Somehow Harry Styles came up. Not at all correlated to the fact that Harry Styles come up on every podcast we've recorded for at least several episodes.
1,000,000%. But I wasn't the one who brought it up. But so we're talking about, Tori was like, okay, what's the song that you skip on the album? So we're like talking about that. And then Becky, who you all might remember from our season one Sororal Conspiracy episode, mm-hmm. my sister who did not watch the episode that we were in fact talking about, Becky was like, oh, you know that song that has the line like Joker with a C-do? And Tori and I like lose our minds. Tori's like, I'm like, Beck, you got that line wrong. And Tori's like, Beck, it is literally the most iconic line, like, that everyone talks about. It's, she's like, we can't tell you now because we're at the table, but we'll tell you after dinner. Becky's like, whatever, Joker with a C-do, like, which I feel like is relatable content because we did just talk about jet skis on Loki.
Yeah.
And we're like, Beck, it's choke her with the sea view. Beck's like, oh man, I was really anyway, so my dad was like there for the first part of the conversation about the Joker with a sea view, but was basically the reason we were like, we will tell you the line later. Sean Hanley is not like ready for cocaine side boob choke her with a sea view.
Fair enough. Anyway. And the ironic thing about that is that, so I was visiting my family like a week and a half, 2 weeks ago back in Colorado. And we agreed, like, Harry Styles was by far the first and most agreeable to like multiple family members at the same time listening of maybe any artist that I can remember.
That artist for the Hanley family is
Billy Joel.
1,000,000%. But, you know, the fact that my dad paid attention and knew that it was Harry and was like, I like this song Matilda, which is like a great song and also a wild thing for my father to say. I feel great about it. I know that our listeners love it when I read my notes, so I'm going to read them about so we can transition back to Stan and Philip.
By your listeners, you mean that's producer Amy loves it when you read your notes.
Producer Amy does love it, but I would venture a guess that our other at least two listeners I think at least two.
Okay.
Beyond producer Amy, Keller and the dude who wrote us that
Mike
letter.
From Orange County.
Mike from Orange County, thank you. I barely remember my sister's name, so I'm not going to remember anybody else's name. There are a lot of them. So these are my notes. It starts with Elizabeth Wig, love. Stan talking to Philip. Jeez, lots of underlines. Oh my God, affair. Why does Stan lie to Philip about Nina? Weird, after telling him so much. What's happening here? Which I think is a good place for us to start with this lying and to transition back to the Americans after Harry Styles' corner.
So, Danielle, I agree. So, Danielle, why does Stan only partially reveal what's happening to Philip, do you think?
I think in the first place, there's like the pragmatic, like, I can't actually like reveal to anybody that Nina is like this like Russian operative. It, like, I can't reveal that piece of it pragmatically, but I also think, like, on a deeper level, it's something that Stan wants to keep for himself. Like, he needs to talk about the affair, but I think it's really important for him that part of this is only his.
So there's several layers of dramatic irony to that particular reading of what is happening with Stan, because obviously not only Nina, but also Arkady, and then in this episode also Oleg, and then whoever is being reported to back at the center in Moscow, know more about Stan and Nina than Stan himself knows about Stan and Nina.
Exactly.
And then this question of what are we lying about and who ends up getting to know things is something that Stan is explicitly concerned with in this conversation as well, right? He says, you can't tell this to Elizabeth, right? I mean, as if, you know, maybe in a quote unquote normal marriage, Phil maybe would keep that from Elizabeth, but not when they're KGB operatives trying to pump information out of Stan whenever they can. Is that going to happen? And then Stan and Philip have this quasi conversation about what they're able to share with their spouses or not share with their spouses. And that Stan has, he thinks that Philip and Elizabeth have it easy as travel agents who work together, because he's like, oh, you all can share everything. And he's precisely half right. And then the half that he is wrong about, he is so profoundly and deeply wrong about.
Yeah.
It's a really kind of like mind fuck of Stan from the external perspective of a viewer of this TV show.
Yeah, because like, it's like, we know all of these things about Philip and Elizabeth and all of, like, we're privy to all these, like, complexities between them. But Stan does have this read, like, you know, pretty on point to the extent that he has it on point, right? The other thing that I was thinking about in terms of this exchange is when Stan asks Philip if he's ever had an affair. Yes. And Philip has a really hard time answering, because on the one hand, and I think it's the same, it raises that same dynamic that you were just describing. Like, on the one hand, no, like, or on the one hand, for the most part, Elizabeth knows about his affairs because they're part of the mission. That's like part and parcel of like what they're doing here. On the other hand, like, we did see the way that, like, his one dalliance in all the time that we've known him with the woman that he used to be in love with, right, causes this major rift. So, like, he is both, he's able to relate to Stan on this, on, like, a physical and emotional level, but also is, like, not actually able to access that because so much of it is a part of his spy life.
Right. And to your point there, that one dalliance, use your word, both Stan and Philip have had sex with a KGB agent. Right? So there's some paralleling of the two of them, even if the whole rest of the situation is entirely different. And Philip, to your point, like, does communicate some of the complexities or uncertainty or lack of resolution or clarity in the situation to Stan when he says, well, we've had our rough patches, but we're pretty solid now, I think. That's actually a very honest, truthful, real response from Philip.
Yeah, it's only when he has to, like, contemplate whether or not he can or how he could, like, tell Stan about these, like, dalliances. And ultimately, he sort of, I think, quickly comes to the conclusion, like, I can't actually talk about any of these. And so it parallels Stan's, like, she's married, right? It parallels the, like, the door that Stan shuts on the experience. They're able to connect, like, emotionally. I love your point that, like, they both slept with a KGB agent. Like, true.
When Stan says we're doomed about he and the person he's having an affair with that he can't disclose to Philip, do you think he is saying that to maintain the cover, or do you think he's saying that because he actually realizes that he and Nina are doomed?
I think he actually realizes that he and Nina are doomed. I can't remember because I watched the episode twice, so now the timeline of the episode is a little bit muddled in my brain. But does this exchange happen before or after all of the stuff with Gad?
It happens after.
Right. So I think that that is part of what is coloring Stan's sort of like analysis that he and Nina are doomed. I think it's a little bit like we're all fucked. Like they're coming to get all of us, and this is a misstep, and could be discovered to be an even bigger misstep than it already feels like it is, right? Like, because Stan really reveres Gad, and so seeing like the authority sort of come towards him and him be reprimanded, I think really shakes Stan.
I would agree with that part of it. The last kind of dynamic of this conversation that I think is worth mentioning, even if it's just briefly, is the question of friendship gets raised by Philip, both in relation to Stan and then later in relation to Elizabeth.
Yeah.
Philip said, tells Stan, "I always like to help a friend," which, LOL. Stan is his only friend, for the record.
Which this is like the second episode that he said that, right? Like last episode when he was like, the kids would go to the Beamans, and Elizabeth's like, you know, don't be ridiculous. And Philip's like, no, we're friends, right? Like, so this is the second time we get that.
Yeah. And then obviously when they're at the kitchen sink, he gives the similar line to Elizabeth when she asks, why did Stan tell you about the affair?
I know it's the 80s, but like the constant racket in this show of like, let's turn on something with noise so that no one can hear us. And the like, we record a podcast. Last week we recorded this podcast together, and you're like, let's just like wait till the air turns on so I can like listen to it so I can filter it out. It's like, I know in the 80s no one was filtering anything out, but it's like, come on, guys, your sink is not really like covering up any of the words you're saying.
Anyway. I will leave this as an open question, because obviously they're not going to muddy up the sound of the show or the dialogue of the show. Yeah. So I wonder if in quote unquote the real life of the show, it actually would be more of an obstacle to bugs or to somebody pointing like a directed parabolic microphone at them. If the radio is on or the TV is loud or the water's running or whatever.
Or the copy machine is going outside.
Or the copy machine is going in the other side of
the closed other room.
When I think it's fair to assume that Elizabeth and Philip probably secretly soundproofed the back office of the travel agency.
100%. And like, I'm sure that they have like gone, they must do sweeps of their own house.
You would think so.
Otherwise, they're also bad at their jobs. Okay, let's talk a little bit about Elizabeth's mission with Brad.
Yeah.
This was really hard for me to watch for a couple of reasons. The first was just sort of asking a question that I think the show wants us to ask, that Claudia is also pushing Elizabeth on, which is how much of the Elizabeth's reaction is the mission, and how much of it is herself and like her own struggles and her sort of like emotional challenges around spying and all that includes at the moment. And then the other piece of it is like, I am really uncomfortable with the weaponization of rape, which I think is something that we see Elizabeth do in here, though I think it is maybe a bit more complicated than that. So I think those are the two things that I want to put on the table for us to discuss.
Yeah. And they're related to one another, obviously, right? Yeah. Both of them are a question of how does Elizabeth's experience of violence shape the work that she does in the present?
Way to phrase that question.
That was a very like academic. That's the way I would phrase the question to my students.
Which is why I loved it.
So let's maybe talk about the emotional state of Elizabeth first, and then kind of work our way back to the concrete ways in which she's weaponizing sexual assault in the episode, in this op, which is a kind of secret op that's separate from the center, from the Residentur, right? This is her, Philip, and Claudia going kind of rogue, but not really rogue, to target the Navy SEAL that Claudia thinks killed Leanne and Emmett and Amelia.
Yeah.
So regardless, so Elizabeth is like, all right, I'm going to find this one sensitive. Maybe we're supposed to read him as queer man in the Navy who's kind of sheltered, who loves classical music, who's not bro-y, so on and so forth. And I'm going to seduce him and convince him to make copies of Larrick is the SEAL guy, to make copies of Larrick's records to get enough information to try to do something against Larrick. Okay. So step two of Elizabeth's process is after they met and listened to some Mozart together in the listening booth at the record store, which we'll talk about.
We'll get there.
They go to a motel with like a six pack, sketchy six pack that Brad's
sketchy awkwardly
brings in there. And they start to make out a little bit, and Brad is kissing Elizabeth, and you can just see on Elizabeth's face that, like, this is not working.
Yeah.
And I think Carrie Russell does a really wonderful job of leaving open the interpretation both that this is exactly what she intended to do for her mission, is to communicate this hesitation so as to set up the claim that she's going to make the next time they meet. And simultaneously, it's reasonable to interpret her as being like, I don't like doing this. I was not ready, or I am not capable of fully committing to this mission.
Yeah, I think that you're right, especially about Carrie Russell's, like, the way that she conveys that sort of, like, both of those things, so that it's not easy for us to discern which one of them is or perhaps could be dominant. And I think this, all of the scenes around this, but especially that first scene with the makeout session in the motel, like, I think could easily be interpreted as either of those, which I think is a testament to her acting. And also, like, I don't know, for me, it, like, I kept trying to explain it away as like, oh, this is what she needs to do. So then later when she's telling the story, it, like, is more believable. But then also it's like, it is believable, but also it does seem like, as we know from, like, other conversations that she's had with Philip, like, she's, her world is shaken up, right? Like, there's like, she feels out of control. And so why wouldn't that also be happening in this particular moment too?
And when Elizabeth says, I'm sorry to Brad at the end of their, like, aborted making out or having sex or whatever, then the question becomes, is she just saying sorry to Brad, or is she also saying sorry to Philip in absentia, to Claudia in absentia, to Leanne and Emmett in absentia, for if she thinks that she is in the moment not carrying out the mission, if this is not part of her plan or her intention, who else is she apologizing to?
I don't think she's apologizing to Claudia.
Fair.
But I think that the question of, like, who else is she apologizing to? I think is a good one. And again, and as our, you know, recurrent and favorite phrase on this podcast, the both and of it all is that it's both of these things, right? It's both that she needs to, for the mission, abort this makeout session so that the story is believable. And it is likely that, like, she's having a really hard time with this. And so she's both sorry to Brad because I'm sure he feels shitty in this moment.
Yeah.
Like, and she recognizes that. And she's sorry that, like, her emotions and her personal life is impacting this moment, even if it is doing so in a way that furthers the story she needs to tell.
And that story she needs to tell comes up in their next meeting. Brad thinks he's never going to see Elizabeth in character ever again. But no, like, they have a breakfast or a coffee or whatever at the diner in Virginia Beach. And Elizabeth tells Brad that she was sexually assaulted by someone who she eventually names as Larrick in town, and that the Navy covered it up. And that, like, her lawyer is like, we can't do anything with this case, so on and so forth. And Brad is seemingly genuinely, like, apologetic and like, oh, I fucked up and I pressured you back at the motel.
Yeah. And so your point a bit earlier that these things are related, right? Like, the experience that Elizabeth is having and that weaponization of rape, right? Like, this is where it comes together. The sexual assault is now being used as it's being mobilized sort of for this broader mission. It just makes me uncomfortable.
It is really uncomfortable. It's the weaponization of it for the mission is, I think, the phrase that you use when you introduce this part of this part of the show. And then also, as we were talking about before the show, Elizabeth was also, she is lying to Brad in the moment and also was sexually assaulted by a superior officer, but of the KGB rather than the Navy or whatever it is that that is happening here. And simultaneously, like, of course, we have extensive records of the U.S. military covering up sexual assaults of people in the U.S., but especially right in foreign countries. So that there's that other layer of reality that's playing into what it is Elizabeth is doing here as well. So it's creepy, and also there's this real element to it.
Yeah, and I think that that was, like, the place where my brain went to, like, thinking about, well, this also is part of Elizabeth's story. It's just not part of this particular story. And so, like, that blending and shifting and, like, the narrative being pieced together from, like, the real, like, the authentic and the inauthentic, I mean, that's the work of spying, right? Like, that's exactly, if we were to, like, overlay a meta narrative onto, like, the dynamics in the show, it would be like authentic versus inauthentic ? And so, like, in the same way that some of the ways the show depicts violence is, like, deeply disturbing for me, I think this is another version of that, which I think means that, like, it's effective, which is also frustrating, but, like,
also frustrating, concerning, and worrying. Yes, for sure. So you mentioned this, Danielle, but Claudia Beck.
Ugh.
What did you feel and what did you think when Claudia walks across the street as Philip and Elizabeth are on their dead drop route?
My notes: what is Claudia doing here? I did not like it. I didn't need to see her back. I didn't like her when she was on the show. I didn't like her in this episode. When she walks across the street, I was like, is this a vision? Is this fake? Then she gets in the car and I was like, oh God, this bitch is back. I was angry.
Claudia understands that Elizabeth is still angry at her. And yet, I mean, so I'm a little bit sinking into this position because of Danielle's very known position on Claudia on this podcast, but
we'll take it.
I think that Claudia is just really, really excellent at what she does in the very circumscribed moral world of KGB spycraft, because she consistently, at most, genuinely cares for the Jennings, and at worst is very interested in pursuing situations in which care for the Jennings and her own experiences and wants overlap with one another. And in this case, that is, she proposes that the conglomerate of Claudia, Philip, and Elizabeth hunt down the person that she suspects or she accuses of killing Leanne and Emmett.
I have a lot to say about this. Some of it we're going to get into in Danielle Dossier, but the thing that I would like to put forward here is, like, Claudia is a narcissist. We saw it in last season.
Who's we here?
The general public watching the show. And she was like, oh, let's do this thing that or rather she, like, drops all these hints to Elizabeth, and Elizabeth's like, I know that you're manipulating me, but I'm going to do it anyway. It's just, like, that feels like narcissism to me. This is another version where she's like, I know better than the center. Like, I don't know. Like, there's something about, like, if we are following along with the structure of authority in the show, like, it is Moscow Center that, like, gives the orders. And Philip and Elizabeth don't do a lot of deviating from the center unless Claudia is in the goddamn mix, and it's very annoying. And I don't like it. I feel like that, like, the I know better than Moscow feels like narcissism to me.
Who is more narcissistic, Elizabeth or Claudia?
I mean, it's a legitimate competition.
Thank you. That's all I wanted to hear. Yeah. All I wanted to hear. We also have the fact that when it comes to interpreting Elizabeth, Claudia is consistently correct. And she's correct in this episode too, right? She says, you came back too soon. You're afraid, too afraid. Of course, Elizabeth responds with, well, there's something wrong with you too. Also correct. But Claudia understands Elizabeth, not in all ways, but in some ways better than Elizabeth understands herself.
That's fine. But also Claudia likes to tell Elizabeth that she understands her more than she understands herself. And that's the part of Claudia that is deeply frustrating.
And that's the part of Claudia running Elizabeth and maintaining the function of power in their relationship.
Yeah.
To be sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I want to get into this a little bit more in Danielle Dossier, but I am frustrated by the reappearance of Claudia and hope that she leaves very soon.
All right. I think that's a good note to move on to borrowed nostalgia for the unremembered 80s as we jump into the segments. It's been a nice long discussion here in the main discussion. There's more in the notes that we could have done, but we'll save it for another time and place. So Danielle, Borrowed Nostalgia for the Unremembered 80s. It's a special version of Borrowed Nostalgia for the Unremembered 80s. Not because Danielle has figured out what the reference is. No, not yet. It's special because we're going all the way back to the 1780s in this Borrowed Nostalgia segment, which I do not remember.
I mean, I definitely don't remember it, but you know, I'm all for a little bit of Mozart on our small TV screens.
So too is Brad, and so too is Elizabeth in disguise and seducing Brad, right? So the name of the episode is A Little Night Music, and Danielle, you're going to pronounce the German, correct? Not me.
Oh, absolutely not. Go ahead.
Which is Ein kleiner Nachtmusik from Mozart, composed in 1787. That gives the episode its name, its title. And that is what is listened to when Elizabeth starts the process of seducing Brad.
I mean, I saw the title of this episode and I was like, is that a Bob Seger song? So not, is that the translation of the Mozart record that they listened to? So, I mean, that's where we all are. Bob Seger does seem a little bit more unremembered 80s than 1780s, but here we are.
That's true. This is the first time I actually made the connection that this was why the episode was named A Little Night Music, which is the English translation of Ein kleiner Nachtmusik. I tried it again. I've never studied German ever. So
I was going to say the Germans killed my relatives. So like, I'm not interested in speaking any German.
That's a very, very reasonable position.
Oh, did I have to read a lot of Kant and Heidegger and Hegel in grad school? In fact, I did, but we're not learning any German.
One of them supporting the people that killed your relatives.
One of them aggressively supporting. Also, I had to study with someone who was the expert on Schmidt, who designed the legal infrastructure of Nazi Germany. So, here we are, political theory, where all the Nazis come home to roost.
Ouch. Not wrong.
All
right. So if we move forward to the 1980s, which we have, I don't have any nostalgia for this because it was in like a Burger King commercial or whatever. But in this episode, we get Modern English's I Melt With You. And that song, if it had never made its way into Burger King or wherever commercial, would have been like a great 80s classic throwback.
Yeah.
And because it was in that commercial, I have zero nostalgia, borrowed or unborrowed, remembered or unremembered for it.
Fair. I feel like that song is like looped in with a lot of other like pop-up video type music that I probably listened to in the 90s that was from the 80s. So I will say that the listening booth in the record store and just like listening booths in general feel like so much a part of my childhood, not records, but like at a Sam Goody, like listening to a CD, like before I bought Crazy Sexy Cool.
it was the go-to store in my youth was Best Buy, right? And there'd be like little stations through the aisles, and like, there'd be like, here are a couple CDs that are, you could use for this particular station.
So. But I love that this episode had the record booth version of it.
Yes.
Like that feels very retro. Yeah.
Actual vinyl, right? We don't have CDs yet. Surely there are cassettes, right? But like we don't have CDs. So they pull out the Mozart vinyl. whatever performance it is of I'm Klein Enough music to listen to adorably nice. In Amazing. The booth with two sets of headphones, right? So they got multiple audio outputs. So it's a fancy sound system there in the listening
booth. Seems very fancy. Yeah. Very sweet.
Very sweet.
We get this, you put this in the notes, but I also love this. We get this exchange between Henry and then Elizabeth and Philip about video games. And Henry's trying to convince his parents that they're good for your brain, which I fucking loved.
Danielle, it's called Intellivision, all right? why would they call it that if it doesn't make you more intelligent, you know?
Oh my God. We didn't have video games growing up. But we had some computer games. So we had Number Munchers and Word Munchers, which we also used to play at school, which were, I think, a version of this where it was good for your brain, but on the computer.
Yeah. I have a realization as we're saying this that, of course, this is a very light Henry episode, as all episodes are very light all Henry episodes. But the prime expression of Henry's actual agency in the world is that he wants video games and he wants his dad to buy a cool new car. So it's like if Philip and Elizabeth in particular are so worried about the secret hidden enemies that their kids are facing, Henry, who they don't really pay a ton of attention to, is the most consumerist of them all.
I was literally just about to say this. I was like, okay, we can be afraid of Paige's religiosity, but what about Henry, worshiping at the altar of capitalism?
yeah Talk about opie to the masses.
My God.
So Henry would like Intellivision. He thinks it's going to make him smarter. That's the case he's making to his parents.
Yeah, we talked about this a little bit earlier, but to me youth groups feel incredibly 80s. Just going to a church youth group in a basement where you were singing this little light of mine. I was like, oh God, it's so 80s. And maybe it's just because we're still in the midst of COVID where I'm like, why are you going to a place with strangers with no masks on? But there was something very 80s about that.
Yeah, I actually don't associate the youth groups with the 80s at all. That's very much because I had so many friends that were in youth groups and cared about it a lot. And that was a major part of their lives. That's nostalgia, not quite nostalgia, for the remembered 90s and early aughts for me.
Fair. We had this neighbor down the street. She and her parents don't live there anymore. It was our only friend on our street. She was a year ahead of me in school, who was part of a Lutheran youth group. And she invited us to the church camp and we made candles. And my mom was it was a version of this where my mom was what do you mean you were at a church today? And we were in fourth grade. It was in the summer where you would just ride your bikes around for the whole day. We went to church camp and my mom was absolutely not. Vicky Hanley was not having it.
Was the candle burned in the house? Did we maintain the candle?
No, and also
it was tainted by Jesus, is what you're saying.
1,000,000%.
Or the Spirit. Might have been the Holy Spirit.
I think also because my mom grew up in a Jewish and Catholic household, so Lutheranism was also a big question mark. And so I think maybe my assumption is if we had been at the convent, which I'm sure we talked about when my sisters were on, for catechism, which is where we all had to go, then it wouldn't have been as surprising. But that we ended up at this, now when I drive by it, it's this evangelical Lutheran church.
Tough look for youth
groups. Tough look. Barred nostalgia. I'm not sure about nostalgia, but definitely the unremembered 80s. What else do we have in barred nostalgia?
So we get a Philip disguise, a new old Philip disguise. So he dresses up as, I guess, an academic to spy on Baklana, about his institution where he's teaching physics. And I just like to point out that this is if Clark was 18% less dorky looking, that's what Philip was going for his academic disguise.
My notes say less dirtbaggy Philip.
Right. And he's the dirtbag is a reliable source of disguise ideas for him. But this is, there are plenty of academic dirtbags. Don't get us wrong here.
Do not get us wrong. Yeah. And on a different kind of podcast would list some of them out, but this is a family show.
Look, if somebody wanted to start a podcast exposing academic dirtbags, I probably would listen to it, let's be honest, and send in some nominees. Okay. Anyway, so academic Philip Disguise, he's got like felt arm pads, elbow pads on the suit. Like,
yeah.
It's an ugly suit, but it's better than Clark's usual attire with mostly Clark-like hair.
It's what people think academics still dress like.
Correct.
Like, Sean Hanley's definitely like, where are your felt elbow patches? I'm like, no, thank you. I'm over here in my old Navy dress.
I'm over here in my prints, my floral prints.
We're like, we go to Western, Dad.
I do not own khakis, nor do I own a blue blazer, so I'm good. Right?
So you're not allowed to go to Midwest.
Correct.
This is honestly like inside baseball for the real ones.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Okay. What else is on this list? If you know.
Also on this list is Arkady is somewhat creepily super into Yuri Andropov, who is, if I remember correctly, currently the head of the KGB and soon to be, as Arkady predicts, the general secretary, unless the head of the Soviet Union. He's like, I fully bought this propaganda of he grew up with nothing and worked his way up through the KGB, and now he's head of the KGB and set to be general secretary. So don't get a lot of Yuri Andropov references in pop culture, so no. I think it's time to uplift them when they happen, even though he was not the greatest dude, I think we could say.
We love a random reference, though. We're all for that, and especially a random reference that, like, strikes John in the heart.
Well, the John that strikes in the heart the most is not McMahon, but Keller.
We'll have to bring it up.
We hope you've enjoyed and drop off time on this podcast that you listen to religiously. I know. Okay. Know. Last thing, we get some like remnants of the Reagan administration has not fully decimated unions in America in this episode, right? Philip is like, because of Stan's creepy friends, we have the plumbers union and we're doing all their travel, and hopefully we can get the Teamsters and then the hotel workers. So Philip's like ready to go with travel agency handling all union business in the Mid-Atlantic region.
Which I was here for, and Elizabeth really shut it down. She was like, relax, bro.
Yeah, stop being so capitalist about it. But like, shouldn't she be happy if they're working with unions? I don't know.
Yeah.
But not making a profit off of the unions. I think that's the
they have to make a profit. They live in America. It's not like, does the KGB pay them? Like, that a big question I have. Great question. Can I get paid by the KGB?
I think we've discussed a number of times on and off air, you and I would be terrible spies.
Terrible spies.
No agency would pay us. None.
Literally none. We are, you know what? We're here to podcast about it. That makes us terrible spies.
Yeah.
Okay. Exactly. Let's get into minor character of the week. John, you had a nominee that you wanted to put out there.
Danielle, I would like to propose that our minor character of the week this week is none other than Paige's Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ.
Absolutely fucking not. In no way, shape, or form. Like, absolutely not. Absolutely not.
Narratively, I would make the case he's the minor character of the week, but do you have a backup because you rejected my suggestion of one third of the Trinity? Can I nominate other thirds of the Trinity?
Honestly, I would take the Holy Spirit over Jesus Christ. Honestly, I would take the Holy Spirit. The one when I was younger, it was like the Father, the Son, the Holy Spirit. And I'm like, what is a Holy Spirit? I went to catechism for a lot of years and I was like, I still don't understand it. I had to like start practicing Judaism to understand what that meant. I think that says something. It does say something.
All right. So Danielle, more down with the Holy Ghost than Jesus. We've learned this today.
I don't like it when we say Holy Ghost.
I figured that'd be the case.
It sounds like a pop culture icon that I don't like. Instead,
would listen to that album.
Harry's Holy Ghost. Oh, that one was for us. Okay. Yeah. By rejecting Jesus, which is a literal ridiculous thing that you proposed here. Like, what is even happening? I'm rejecting that. And instead, I say that we go with Kelly, who is played wonderfully by Lizzie Clement. She definitely has the best hair that we have seen thus far in the series.
I think that's probably true. So Kelly with an I is the person that Paige met on the bus. That was an interesting conversation. She's the one that literally like takes Paige by the hand and brings her into the youth group singing circle for some.
This little light of mine. Line.
One might say that they shone together.
Oh my God, I hate it here. Okay, let's get into the dossier because I might vomit on air.
there's a lot in the dossier. I'm hoping there's more uncomfortable Christian references in the dossier, but I'm not holding out my hope too much.
I'm not trying to have more Christian references.
I'll see what I can do.
Yeah. Okay. So first in the dossier is like Claudia is 1,000,000% behind the Emmett and Leanne murders. Like it, I don't know. She's trying to like get them off the scent. Like she's like, oh, I know who did it. It's this other dude who like we can conveniently kill. That other dude, I'm sure, saw Claudia kill or like give up Emmett and Leanne or whatever it is. Claudia is behind the Emmett and Leanne murders. I'm not sure if she did it or if she's just the reason that they got murdered. But like either way, Claudia, bad news, which was also the second thought I had when she walked on screen. I was like, this bitch, like she killed Emmett and Leanne. I know it in my bones. So that's one.
Extremely no comment here.
Okay, fine. I'm going to take that as I am 1,000,000% correct. The second entry in the dossier is that Kelly, while she is our minor character of the week, not Jesus Christ, is bad news. Here is like a great rule of thumb. Like, never trust anyone who takes you to a church youth group. I am Team Elizabeth on this one. I'm like, church is infecting your brain. Like, this is not like the youth group. Oh, come sing these fun songs with us that like don't really like have any religious imagery, except they're all religious imagery. Like, let us indoctrinate you. Like, look, coo with the cute boys, like, except that they're going to like, I don't know, like make you their wife and hide you in a basement. I'm not sure, but Kelly, bad news. Don't trust anyone who takes you to a church youth group.
I have no comment about Kelly. I do have a comment that I think be wary of proselytizers who want to take you to mediocrely sing songs in a youth group is a great rule to live by.
Yeah. I mean, I'm like, I don't want to be in anyone's basement, like ever. And definitely not the basement of a church. Oh my God. I couldn't think of a place I want to be less. I had to go, one of the professors at Penn, who's like a, you know, brilliant professor, very involved in left politics in Philadelphia, would like often speak in West Philly. And so we would like go to hear him speak or like, you know, hang out with him after he spoke. He was like always speaking in the basement of the Unitarian Church. I'm like, why does it always have to be a church?
Okay, it doesn't have to be a church. The Unitarians, that's acceptable.
I mean, I went there a lot of times and I would not go to other churches, but it's just like, it's always in a church. It's always a church. At least the Unitarians didn't have like crazy imagery, which again, we didn't get in this church basement, for which I was thankful for.
I mean, like I have to put my cards on the table here that like when I was in undergrad, the like people that I learned anti-war activism from, mm-hmm. like some of the prominent groups there were like your Jesuits and your Quakers. And then like old lefty people who found their way to the Green Party. Like those were the cohorts. Yeah. So
I'm not angry at the people that go to these places. I'm angry at the physical location, like in a church basement.
I definitely like did some protest organizing meetings in the Quaker church in Denver.
But also like the Quaker Meeting House, what I do love about it is people are like, I'm moved to speak, and they just stand up and start speaking. Like there's something about that that feels like very close to the kinds of politics that I'm interested in theorizing.
Mm. All right. So when Danielle writes about the Quakers, that's when you know she's been fully Kelly-billed and brought into the youth group of her own.
Exactly. Now, on to my last entry in the dossier. Something we haven't talked about yet, which we'll get into a little bit in Gloss, but it's Martha suspecting Clark feels very dangerous, suspicious. I like her being on the phone with her mom feels weird. The whole, and then like calling Clark and threatening him, threatening to put his name on the form, which just
on
like,
a federal job application for the FBI.
It just like, it feels like Martha is starting to be onto something. Though maybe hasn't fully gotten there yet. I was feeling stressed out when she was like calling Clark a million times and being very angry on the phone.
Yeah. No comment about Martha's Clark's-ness this week.
Yeah. I just wanted to open it in the dossier, but let's talk a little bit, let's get into Glass and let's talk a little bit about the, like that, that threatening to put Clark's name down. Like, what did you make of that?
So in some ways, that's not the most interesting part of Martha and Clark this week for me. It's more
okay.
The fight that Clark Phillips stages with Martha that I think goes further than he probably intended it to ahead of time as a way for him to work out his general frustration with the emotional situation of he actually probably would like to work on his marriage with Elizabeth, but he has to be at Martha's however many nights a week. And they were supposed to have this romantic long morning together, but the Martha being on the phone with her mom gives him the excuse he thinks he needs to leave early so that he can go track Baklanov or whatever. I think that's what he goes to do, if I remember correctly. So just like the fight that they have, which is the first time they've like yelled at one another in this way that I think we've seen, if I'm remembering correctly.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that you're right that the going like a step farther than he perhaps intended it to, and I think we see that on Matthew Reese's face. Like, we see him be, I read it as like a bit conflicted over, I couldn't decide if it was like how easy it was to get into this fight or how intense the fight was. Like, there was definitely something conflicted there. And I was having a little bit of trouble like reading what the conflict was. So I think like your point is helpful there.
Yeah. If Philip was fully in control and carrying this out the way he wanted to, like any other mission, the fight would have been over after the first half.
Yeah.
And then he would have been peaced out.
Yeah. I think that that's right. It also, there was part of me that's like, oh, finally. Like, finally they're having a fight because, like, we have to sort of extract ourselves from Martha, I feel like. Two things. The first is that when Martha was calling Clark to threaten to put his name down, I was like, to me, this means that Martha is going to die soon. So maybe that's an entry in the dossier, too. But did she have, was she recording something? Like, she had like a tape or like something. And
she's like playing with considering the device that's recording from the pen. Right. So like, that's the recorder that's hidden as like part of her makeup case.
Right.
That she has to have in her purse at FBI headquarters.
Right.
To
well,
pick up the bug in Gad's office.
And like, we, at least as far as like the way this episode unfolded, like Martha doesn't know that anything's up with Gad, right? Like
her and Stan exchange this knowing look as Stan exits the office is all.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah. I was like having trouble putting together those pieces. So I'm like interested to see the Martha and Clark and Stan and Gad of it all. I'm like, there's tension is heightening there, and I'm interested to see where it goes.
Yeah, and we get a little bit of that tension in the FBI office itself with Gad being, as he calls it, being layered. So then bringing in somebody over him and the chain of authority to essentially kind of push him out or push his perspective or power or ideas out as a result of the killing of Vlad from last season.
Right.
Where the deputy AG communicates that he understands that it was, if not Stan himself, but the Gad and Gad's team is responsible for assassinating Vlad and killing him. The State Department is giving him pushback, but he's like fine with it as deputy AG, but he has to like do this to save face or whatever the case may be. So Gad's like kind of on the outs as of this episode.
Yeah, which to me happened sort of abruptly. Stuff where Ged maybe could or should have been disciplined more obviously versus now where it's like it feels slightly arbitrary, though I guess it's not, because I think it also coincides with like it coincides with Stan getting the award, right? It coincides with Stan sort of like taking initiative and doing so in a way with, in the parlance of our podcast, like being good at his job.
Right. And I agree that it's like a little abrupt and like it's a kind of strange thing to happen. But I think accounting for the Reagan administrationness of it all kind of solves that problem, because it's like, fine, go be extra legal, go do your extrajudicial killings and bullshit. But yeah, occasionally we're going to have to do something to give the illusion or the pretension of rule of law. Right. And so this is maintaining that illusion.
Yeah, that's helpful in it, and it makes sense to me.
Right. So the other part of DC spying that's happening is there's developments with regards to our friend Oleg Igorovich Burov, who has pulled the strings. Arkady is pissed about this, has pulled strings with his dad, the deputy transportation minister, to get a special security clearance that gives him access not only to files about Baklanov, but it turns out also to files with Nina's reports of her op against Stan.
I thought that Nina's read of this situation was fascinating. When Arkady comes in, and so like Oleg gets his like clearance up, there's this exchange with Arkady. Arkady is like clearly, I want to say like clearly frustrated by this, but like knows that he can't really do anything about it. And then Arkady and Nina have this exchange where Nina essentially, where Arkady says to Nina, like, he's getting the files, but he's not getting your file. Like, he's getting your reports, but he's not getting your files. So he doesn't know that you betrayed the center. And Nina's like, right, but we both know that, like, he wants to know. And even if he doesn't have, like, official access to it, he'll figure out how to get it. And I thought that that was, like, it just, like, Nina is such a, she's so smart and she's so good at this. And it makes me feel so bad that she's in so deep.
Right. I mean, it's a bit of a classic. We've talked around this, but I think it's worth stating directly. Nina exemplifies the person who is in an oppressive society, or in this case, institution, who has to know more about the way that that institution works, and particularly the informal norms and mechanisms and processes that work to empower the institution, reproduce the power relations within it. Yeah. It's another example of her kind of exhibiting that sort of knowledge, I think.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And like, of course she knows that. And of course, like, she is aware of this dynamic, and Arkady, like, is not. I mean, once she says it to him, he's like, yeah, that's like, you're right. Mm-hmm. But it's just fascinating to me. Like, Nina is so quiet so much of the time and then has these like moments of brilliance. And it just like, it is, there's something really powerful about that. And there's something incredibly like disempowering thinking through Nina, like in relation to oppression.
And that's on display within the internal politics of the office in other ways in this episode too, right? So like we have the Oleg Arkady, like pissing match, dick measuring contest, choose your like phallic reference or phallic phrase, right? Which I think is the best way to read that. Like, yes, totally, there's internal KGB politics, but there's also like who has more power between the two of us. Arkady's really mad, really happy to be superior to Oleg in the beginning, and then is really, as you said, mad when he turns out that Oleg pulled strings. And Arkady, like, not low-key, but fairly medium or high-key, calls out the nepotism, and so much so is accusing Oleg of already becoming Western by using his personal connections to advance. And so that's contrasted, of course, with the Andropov worked himself up and pulled himself up by his bootstraps line that he gives to Oleg, where Oleg's just kind of pulling these strings. So you have like the dick measuring contest on the one hand. Then you have the Oleg Nina conversation near the end of the episode on the other, right? And Oleg is, I would say, both trying to like make a power play against Nina and exhibit genuine concern on some level with his bullshit philosophy about like the parts of the body that can love is what he is. That's literally the phrase he uses, it, the parts of the body that can love. And he worries that those parts of the body will lead to Stan figuring out what's happening with Nina. And in response, Nina, to your point of like, she's quiet but brutal in her perceptive, is my soul is fine. How is yours? That's her response.
Yeah. Well, because like she doesn't want any of the attention on herself. I think that's like the paradoxical sort of situation here is like there then is all this focus on Nina. And I think Oleg exemplifies this, like his eyes are trained on Nina. That's part of why she's like, that's part of what she's saying to Arkady, like, like, and yet, and Nina's producing these reports, she's producing this thing that has to like put her experience front and center. But my read on her is that she doesn't want to be front and center for any of this.
100% agree with you there.
Should we talk a little bit about Brad as a vantage point on the Navy or the U.S. military?
Yeah, so we briefly touched on this earlier, so we can do this quickly, in that Brad like says to Elizabeth's character that, you know, I'm not a traditional like Navy guy or military guy. I forget the exact wording that he uses, right? I'm not the usual military guy is what he says. And like, he is like nice and sensitive and caring and not bro-y and likes classical music and all of that. So just that he is both this agent of violence and also a perspective on, or that standpoint on, the people who occupy the institution that carries out that violence. So I just thought that Brad as a character plays this interesting role. Like, he reveals things about Elizabeth because of the op that she is running against him.
Yeah.
And maybe part of the Elizabeth response we discussed above is related to how she's playing off of Brad specifically as a character. But then also he's providing this kind of reflection on the military itself. And like, but also, like, is Brad propaganda is, I think, a question.
I'm laughing because we were talking about someone on the latest Loki episode as ACAB, but like, thinking about Brad as propaganda is, like, of course the opposite on this show is true, right? No, I think that those are all really good observations.
I'm going to say in general, though, one of the things that is most admirable about the Americans is that it is definitively not propaganda.
Oh, 100%. But and yet there are these characters that like raise the propaganda question mark for us, just to reinforce that, like, how not propaganda the show is. Like, see Stan being bad at his job most of the time.
See the FBI doing all sorts of illegal shit, including extrajudicial murders.
Yeah, exactly. So I think the last thing that we have in Gloss is the, like, aggressively brutal fight scene that at the end of the episode that we haven't talked about yet.
Yeah.
What did you think about this?
So plot-wise, we should just perhaps situate this, that it is they're trying to abduct Baklanov. They presume, because they're also running the secret off-books op against Larrick, they haven't quite done their diligence. So they think that they're like, Baklanov is this kind of nebbishy, like, academic guy who is going to be easy to abduct and like shove in the trunk and be on with it for quote unquote forced repatriation.
Yeah.
And that is kind of true in the sense that he gets jumped by Philip, gets chloroformed, gets shoved into the trunk.
Right.
But his mistress turns out to be like a very adept fighter and is perhaps like part of his security team. And then there's out of nowhere, random additional guy, a very good fighter who seemingly must be part of some kind of security team or counter intel team on Baklanov, which should give some indication of how important he is. I just want to note that.
Yeah.
That he would have this kind of level of like hidden protection. But all that is to say, that's what's happening in the plot. This is one of the most effortful fight scenes.
Totally.
Right? It's no one is like winning the fight very easily. Everyone is like getting the shit kicked out of them or getting their hands slammed in the fucking trunk like 10 or 15 times, not exaggerating.
Not exaggerating. And I think this brings back up the point of like Elizabeth, like not being okay. Right. And you see it in Philip's face when he's like, he goes to stop her. And actually that kind of like messes up the whole thing.
Sure does.
Because, like Chekhov's mistress on the ground, like flash to her, not like waking up. It's like the T-Rex eye opening in Jurassic Park.
Question. Have you seen Dominion yet?
Of course I've seen Dominion.
Okay.
Yeah.
I also would like to alert the listeners that TIL, Danielle saw an advanced screening of Lightyear.
It is what it is.
It is what it is. If you know, you know, as we've already said before.
If you know, you know.
I don't know on this one for the record. I'm sorry. This was an interruption of an actual serious point, but.
Be honest. Be honest. We have to keep that in.
Oh, for sure. Keeping that in.
No, but the point I was trying to make before I was rudely interrupted.
By your Jurassic Park reference.
Honestly, me interrupting myself is like the most classic me thing in the entire world. Oh my God. It's like why it's so hard for me to like get 1,000 words down on the page every day. It's like I'm constantly interrupting myself.
Or so hard for like us to write a thing with a specific word length. Like why not just write 2,000 more words than that?
Yeah. Or like, you know, every journal has a different word limit. Very annoying. Anyway, we digress a ton. The point I was trying to make is like about Chekhov's mistress. She like starts to like, you know, move a tiny bit on the ground. She's like shivers and it's like, okay, well, she's definitely getting away. The question is just how. Philip comes over to like stop Elizabeth from literally smashing this man's hand in the trunk, which is a painful thing to watch. And all of a sudden, like, the car just takes off. And it's like, that can't be good for anybody.
Because Baklanov still in the trunk. Knocked
exactly.
Down
exactly. From the chloroform.
Yeah. But you call the fight scene brutal. It's effortful.
Yeah.
It's, like, full of what would presumably actually happen to somebody in this brutal of a fight. None of them are in good shape. It's the opposite of the other show that we're covering this summer, I would say.
I think that that's right. for sure. Yeah. The only other piece that I wanted to just put out there is there's like something interesting happening with gender balance and the fighting. So Philip is fighting the like female presenting person and Elizabeth is fighting the male presenting person. Yeah. And I just thought that was both consistent with the show, like, right. And kind of like consistent with the roles that they take on in like a conventional picture of marriage. Yeah. So it was just interesting how the fight scene was playing around with that a little bit.
Yeah. Great question. I want to ask a follow-up question. That is, do you think that like they're going to one of their secret like safe houses or spots or something has like a boxing ring or like a gym? How are they staying in this good of fighting shape? This is a practical spy question that I've always wondered about the Americans.
Yeah. I mean, I would say, first of all, I'm sure racquetball is like helping Philip out.
Definitely. Definitely. Good, like live quick twitch muscles.
Exactly. But I think the other thing is like, if you're doing something like this semi-regularly, or you're always on your toes and your like fast twitch muscles are always like activated, then like you are staying in this kind of shape.
Good call.
That's what I have to say about that.
All right. I like it. Shall we go to the cave?
Let's go to the cave.
Danielle, so I am going to throw this one over to you. I have very, very minimal knowledge, like half of one grad school seminar session on our boy Augustine. So Augustine, the cave, we're going there. He was a Plato fan, so he belongs in the cave. That's big Plato fan. There's not much more I know, so I'm going to turn this one over to you.
So, fun fact, the first time I ever gave a lecture in Hebrew, it was on Augustine's City of God. I was mostly fluent in Hebrew and had never read Augustine before and had to give an hour-long lecture on the text to a group of Israeli undergrads who had better Hebrew than me. It was nerve-wracking, but... So I have a little bit of Augustine background, though not a ton. But I think like the thing that's relevant for us here, so I would say Augustine's most famous work, though not his only famous work, but his most famous work is City of God. I would say the big idea in that text that's relevant for us here is that there is sort of like, there is both the sort of earthly city and the heavenly city, right? There's the world that we live in, the world to come. You can sort of phrase it in different ways. And these are separate, but like the way that you act on earth, and this is, I think, like a core Christian belief, the way that you act on earth is what gains you entry into this kind of heaven or the city of God.
Unless and you're predestined, but we're not quite there yet.
Not with Augustine. But I think the thing that part of the reason why like Augustine and Plato often get read together. And Augustine is like a Neoplatonist. So he's engaging with Plato. He's interested in the Republic. He's interested in the idea of the forms. But like the place where Augustine departs from Plato is that these are God-given. These are heavenly. This is about like salvation, right? This is not about living the good life on earth. Like that's where Plato gets it wrong. It's about like the like entry into the utopia of heaven. Fine. I think like what is interesting and relevant for this episode is that part of what Elizabeth is frustrated by is like the entry of the belief that there is something beyond the life we live on earth, right? Like that thinking about the like heaven or salvation or religion, right, is taking away from the materiality of our existence in the world and our experience that we live. And so I think like there's a bit of Elizabeth sort of in the schema, Elizabeth is like herself, like much more Platonic than Augustinian in her approach and in her frustration about Paige's newfound pull towards religion.
Very, very well done. I mean, it takes us back, of course, to the opening discussion we had about Paige's religiosity and particularly Elizabeth's negative response to it, because not only is she full team City of Man in the dichotomy that Augustine sets up, but also there is no city of God that exists, right? She's a like intensely committed historical materialist in like the Marxist-Leninist sense of the term. And so like, I'm going to give us a bonus cave dweller this week. And that is like, I think we got to at least drop Benjamin in here as like a person who wants to add a little more transcendence, add a little messianism to Marxist historical materialism. In fact, like that's the point of the theses on the concept of history, right? That's how he opens it. And so I think that, you know, we talked earlier about like, okay, in which way are there kind of these formal, like isometric things between Marxism and Christianity or whatever. Yeah. And Benjamin, of course, is coming at it through like a messianic notion of Judaism, but he's trying to do something different with Marxism and in a way that I have always found kind of particularly generative.
Yeah, and I think that like, one, I think Benjamin is a really interesting companion to Augustine here, right? Like, and thinking about them together and how they both are helping us parse what's happening in this episode, I think like it's kind of a fascinating pairing.
Yeah.
Though I don't know how much they would like being in the cave together.
They would dislike it strongly.
Although like Augustine does have these moments where he's more like, there are parts of Augustine's description of like the earthly city that are like he understands why, and this is like his rendering, like why Plato is like seduced by the earthly city. And I think like Benjamin is coming at it from the other way, where, like, it's not that you're seduced by the earthly city. It's that, like, there is a place in which the, like, the transcendent and the earthly have to come together. And, like, when we accept the coming together, that's when we can kind of, like, see clearly.
Yeah. I mean, it's almost, you know, are you suggesting that, like, the confessions were the arcades of the fourth century?
Ooh,
the arcade project of the fourth century?
I haven't read the Arcade Project, though it's like a thing I know I need to read, but I think that that's right.
Also, I don't think that that's right.
I love the Confessions. I love the Confessions.
Never read them.
Oh, it's, you know what's great?
Fourth century, fifth century? I might have to Wikipedia this. I'm forgetting
it
my...
I believe it's fourth century CE.
Wikipedia gives him as 354 to 430 CE. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, Roman Empire.
Yep.
I know my, I had to like give a whole description of like, you know, where Augustine lived and who he looked up to and da, 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 da. I have that lecture somewhere. It is written in Hebrew.
Well, that's for the Patreon. It's like you will either redo it again in Hebrew or you can do it in English. It's your call for the patrons that we don't have because we haven't done a Patreon. But if we did, Danielle lectures potentially in Hebrew about Augustine is on
1,000,000%
for patron benefits.
1,000,000%. We can have guests, my friends who I made listen to that lecture 7 million times to make sure that I wasn't saying anything like really inappropriate in Hebrew.
Great. Good call.
All right. Well, we've got Benjamin and Augustine in the cave, some good, you know, onomatopoeia happening there. Mm-hmm. And I think we leave them in the cave for now because I suspect that we'll come back to both of them.
I think that's probably right. This has been a long episode. Thank you, listeners, for coming on this journey with us. By far our longest non-guest episode of Not Quite Great Books.
A TV podcast.
Oh, I didn't. I wasn't closing. I have.
Sorry, let's do it again.
This has been by far our longest non-guest episode, Danielle. How do you feel about that?
I feel great about it. I feel like, you know, we wanted to like stretch our legs in this episode, and I needed a lot of space to rant about Jesus.
I mean, I see. That's interesting. You said that. I was going to say that, like, it's really the Holy Spirit that carried us through
and sustained us through
an hour and 40 plus minutes of podcasting about this episode.
Oh my God. All right. Well, next up in the feed will be Loki season 1, episode 5.
Correct.
On Tuesday. And then next Thursday, you'll get American season 2, episode 5, which is called The Deal.
Right. Thank you to producer Amy. One might even say, this will be the last time I do this, Danielle. One might even say that Danielle, Amy, and John are the real Holy Trinity all along.
Oh my God.
So thanks, producer Amy. She would also not like that. She would also not like that.
But I think she would appreciate that it got under my skin.
Correct. I think every part of that is correct. So thank you, listeners, for joining us on this, the most holy of episodes on Not Quite Great Books.
A TV, not a God podcast.
Thank you for joining us on another episode of Not Quite Great Books, a TV podcast. It's created by Daniel Hanley and John McMahon, and indirectly, producer Amy. You can find us on Twitter at NotGreatBooksTV. You can email us at NotGreatBooksTV@gmail.com if you have comments or questions that we might potentially read and respond to on air. Subscribe, download, rate, review us, tell your friends to find us at Apple Podcasts, Podbean, Spotify, and Amazon Music, and Google Podcasts. We would like to thank Less FM for Electro Trend 60s, which is the music that you heard at the beginning and you are hearing right now. Until next time, go play some racquetball.